This is Kelly Henderson, and you are listening to the Velvet's Edge podcast. So you guys know that I am fascinated with human beings and just how we work and why we are driven to do what we do, both emotionally and mentally. I've been extremely fascinated with narcissism, as it is such a big word in our culture these days, especially with everything in our society, from social media to reality TV. But what if the only form of narcissism wasn't full-blown narcissistic personality disorder? What if narcissism was actually measured on a scale and some people were higher on the scale than others? For instance, is that ex of yours actually a narcissist or maybe just an asshole? Or how much narcissism do you think that you actually have? Dr. Keith Campbell asks all of these questions in his new book, The New Science of Narcissism, where he believes that this scale is the new way to measure how much narcissism truly exists in our culture. Dr. Campbell was one of the most insightful and down-to-earth interviews that I had all year, and therefore there was just no way it couldn't be a part of one of my favorite conversations. Hope you guys enjoyed as much as I did. Here's Dr. Keith Campbell. Okay, so I found you because I don't remember exactly what I was reading, but there was an article talking about the overuse of the word narcissism now and how, you know, in our culture, we're kind of like, I have this tendency to be like, ugh, my ex is such a narcissist. You know, I've had this tendency right. to just associate the people I've dated in the past with narcissists. And while they may be, what I found so fascinating with what you're saying is that there's a spectrum out there. And so I want to kind of talk a little bit about that today and just kind of our society's association with the word narcissism. But could you start with just giving everyone kind of a grand scale definition of the word narcissism?
Yeah, for sure. What you're telling me is something I've heard, you know, from other people as well. And it's the idea that we use the term narcissism and we're kind of using it pejoratively. It's, you know, it's about the ex, and it's usually kind of negative, and it's usually saying the person sort of, we use it like a jerk.
Yeah.
Maybe selfish jerk.
Yes.
So like, how's the ex? Yeah, he's just kind of a narcissist. I'm over it. What does that mean? Well, he's kind of a selfish jerk and cheated on me. Versus he was just sort of nice and boring, and I just bailed on him.
Right.
You know, so the narcissist, you kind of get an idea across, but it's not very detailed. And in the world of psychology, the world of research, where I live, we have this like a more expansive definition of narcissism that captures some of these ideas. But I'll just go through it and stop me if I'm too boring at any point.
Okay.
But we talk about narcissism first as a trait, and that means that people exist on a spectrum or a continuum from sort of high levels to low levels, and most people are sort of in the middle.
Okay.
And when we talk about narcissism, we really use two different terms. And what most people are using is when they talk about narcissism, it's talking about what we call grandiose narcissism, which is this narcissism that has, imagine having a sense of entitlement and thinking you're special and important, maybe not being super empathetic with people, but also being outgoing and confident and extroverted and maybe charismatic and maybe likable or energetic when you first meet the person. And so when you take this combination of kind of entitlement and self-importance, but also likability and extroversion, and you get this kind of Iron Man character, what a Tony Stark character or politician character, it can be something that's very likable. So this grandiose narcissism is the trait we see in actors and politicians and, you know, country music. You probably see some of this, where people who are, you know, rise to success very easily, but you can have bad relationships with them, which I'll talk about.
Right.
And then the other side of narcissism is what we call vulnerable narcissism. And this is what you see more in the clinical world, in clinical settings and therapy settings. And these are folks that have that sense of entitlement. They think they're better than other people, same as, you know, same as grandiose narcissists. But they also are a little bit insecure. They're kind of depressed or anxious. They have some low self-esteem. They're vulnerable to criticism. So their feelings are threatened pretty easily. They go up and down and how good they feel about themselves. And people who are vulnerably narcissistic, we don't end up voting for president. We don't end up seeing them perform. We don't end up dating them quite as much because they're not as outgoing and likable. But they end up in these clinical offices with depression and anxiety because they're like, God, how come people don't appreciate how great I am? How come people don't know how attractive I am? You know, how come I'm not getting all the girls? Right. How come John is? He doesn't have what I have. I'm a legend, but I'm scared to talk to anyone. And so you have these two faces of narcissism that exist, and both of them are traits on a continuum. And you can find people that are grandiose and vulnerable. So they're grandiose, but they have thin skin too. So you can get a mix. And then the third way we talk about narcissism is a very extreme form, which is a personality disorder called narcissistic personality disorder, or NPD. And that is a very extreme form of narcissism that leads to problems or impairment. So to have a clinical disorder, a clinical level of narcissism, it has to be messing up your life in a way that's so intense that you need therapy or treatment. So maybe you're ruining your marriage because of your infidelity, or maybe you're ruining your business because you're too overconfident and you don't take feedback from people and you make a bunch of dumb risks and you won't learn from mistakes. Or maybe you're investing poorly because you're always overestimating your ability. So it could be, you can have your narcissism that becomes so extreme that it messes up your life and is a disorder. But you can be really narcissistic and not have a disorder. It's just your personality.
Okay. I have so many questions about that part of it. Because just like what I was saying about the ex-boyfriend situation. Like, I mean, your description of a grandiose narcissist, literally, probably, I mean, it just really sounds like a lot of my exes. So, I mean, they're very charming, you're very drawn to them and all of these things, but it's when you actually get within the relationship that it becomes a problem. So my question is though, like if someone is just has narcissistic traits let me start over. First question, do we all have some narcissism in us?
Yes, I mean, it's a continuum, and sort of by definition, we're all on there at some level or another. So if I gave a narcissistic personality inventory, the 100 people, everybody's on there.
Okay.
But you're going to find a certain number of people that are close to the top, and there's no real line where you say, oh, that's narcissism and that's not. But you're going to find a certain amount of people that are at the high end. But most people on narcissism measures are in the middle or kind of low. You know, it's just you find some that are in the high end.
So the way that you talk about it sounds like it's not that big of a deal. But like what we were saying about the exes, I'm like, oh, I got to get away from this person. Like it's,
it's not that big a deal for your ex. It's a big deal for you.
Right.
If that makes sense. So the relationship thing is so interesting, and it leads to so many problems with narcissism because, as you said, that the ex, we're talking about just the generic grandiose narcissistic ex, not yours, but just in general, somebody who's charming, confident, probably likable when you met him, seemed to know what he was doing, seemed to have a way about life. You get in a relationship with somebody like that, the way relationships work in our culture generally is you start a relationship that usually starts kind of shallow and fun.
Right.
You find somebody who's sort of attractive and you go out a few times. It's really fun. You have a great time. You get a rush. You're like, yeah, I really like this person. This is great. And then after a few months, you start becoming more emotionally intimate with the person. So you start focusing on caring. You start focusing on maybe we want to make a commitment. You know, maybe we even want to move in, or maybe we want to get married or fall in love. You know, and that transition that happens in relationships, if you want to take them to the next level, with people who are narcissistic, that doesn't happen well. Because when you get to that part about the emotion and commitment and, you know, you can't hit on all my friends and, you know, you got to be there emotionally, that's not their field. That's not where they do really well. So when you get to that phase in the relationship, it usually starts to fall apart. Or can start to fall apart.
Right. And, okay, go ahead. Sorry.
And so what often happens, I mean, the story is that, you know, you get in a relationship, you're in it a few months, things aren't going well, you start going, well, maybe I'm doing something wrong, why is this guy not as interested as you seem to be, there's something wrong with me, I'll try to be nicer, I'll try to be more loving. Well, lo and behold, if you're more loving, that kind of pushes the person away, because they go, well, I can get away with anything now. Mm-hmm. And it sort of backfires, and it falls apart, and the person, that the narcissist, is on to somebody else already. And you're sitting there for the next 3 months going, what the hell did I do wrong? I'm an idiot. How did I not see that coming? What a moron. You know, I'm a bad person who can't handle relationships. And you're like, no, you're totally fine. You just kind of with somebody who wasn't that interested in commitment. Right. They're interested in commitment on their terms, but not on the terms that work for both of you.
So
yeah.
Well, you say that it's not an issue for them, but isn't that creating problems in their life?
So I was a little glib when I said that, and it does cause issues for the narcissist, but those issues are usually a little more long term. So what happens to the ex-boyfriend is he goes through this relationship a few times, and he looks around and he goes, God, my friends are married, and I see some of them have families. And they're getting something. They have this love, and I don't have that. And maybe I'm missing something. Maybe I need to figure out how to change so I can have a little more committed relationship. And that's when you start seeing people who are narcissistic start seeing that their life choices have some consequences.
Okay. I see what you're saying.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
A little later. And when I hear from people, you know, I hear from 10 people who had a bad relationship with somebody narcissistic. For everybody who says, look, I'm kind of narcissistic, Keith, and I want love and I want a family, but I'm blowing it.
Yeah.
You know, but that does happen. It's just usually a little more long term.
So it's just a little later once they start realizing or seeing other people go through that process.
Yeah, I think and it's the way relationships work in our culture, because we have these sort of love attraction relationships, and they're very individualistic. If you go find dudes or whatever, you'll find people on Tinder. If we were in India, and it's arranged marriage, then this wouldn't be an issue, because you just end up with somebody, and then you'd have to learn to love them.
Right. Okay, I see. So when does it actually become a problem? Because you say, like, you know, maybe we all have a little bit of narcissism in us. And I do want to talk a little bit about that test that you can take. But if there's a spectrum and we're all on it in some capacity, when is it actually an issue? Is it when it becomes a disorder, or is it just if you're super high in narcissism? Like, what does that look like?
I think it's a great question, and I generally think of personality traits as trade-offs, meaning, you know, narcissism really would help me in certain situations, like doing podcasts, for example, or,
yeah,
you know, stand out there and tell the world you're a legend,
yeah,
you know, or you're an expert. I mean, you got to have some ego to do that. And there are other times where ego really hurts you. So if I'm with my kids, or I'm with my dog, or I'm with my wife, and you know, we're trying to talk and I'm trying to listen, you know, my ego sort of interferes. And so the way I like to think about it is that we really want our personality to be flexible and adapt to the situation.
Okay.
So we want to be able to be confident when it's time to be confident, but when it's not time to be confident, we need to be able to dial that back. And maybe we want to be super creative when it's time to be creative, but when we're not, you know, when it's time to just get in line and follow the rules, we want to turn that back. And, you know, so we have these different traits, and they work, you know, in different places we want to have more or less. And so kind of a healthy personality is somebody who's psychologically flexible, meaning they can move around these traits depending on what they need. Where people get in trouble is when they become rigid or inflexible, and they can't really change.
So they're one way all the time.
Yes. So no matter what the situation is, it's like, what about my ego needs? Like, dude, we're in a pandemic. You know, you're not getting your burger, man. It's a pandemic. Like, what about my burger? It's like, pandemic, man. Let it go. If you can't just let it go, you're going to suffer, because you're like, where are my needs being met? No one's really thinking about your needs. Everyone's struggling right now, my friend.
Okay, well, tell me a little more about ego needs, because I will tell you this. When I was reading your book, The New Science of Narcissism, I'm reading it and I'm like, you know, like I said earlier, I'm like, ugh, all my exes. Then I'm reading it and I'm reading all these traits and I was like, holy shit, am I a narcissist? Like, you start to like put yourself on it. I started to really ask myself these hard questions. And like what you just said about ego needs, like, we all have needs, right? Especially in like a relationship, for instance. Like, where is the line, I guess, is what I'm trying to figure out, of just getting needs met and being in a healthy relationship and being a healthy person versus being on the opposite end of that. And, you know, I guess like what you're saying, staying in the ego place all the time.
Yeah, you know, a lot of this is about balance and okay. being in your industry and everything else. I mean, you know, you're in a celebrity field, you got to look like a celebrity. And so this stuff is important. One place I think it's really important, I say, look, you can worry about your ego and being the best and being the hottest and being the most popular, and that's all cool, as long as you're a loving person, as long as you have connections, as long as you have compassion.
Yeah.
And so when I look at all the problems of narcissism, because it's very easy to just go, look, you're narcissistic, don't be such an egomaniac. But like, well, then who's going to jump on stage and start reciting poetry?
Right.
You know, who's going to put up those crazy pictures that look like, you know, the kid drew them and say it's modern art? You need an ego for somebody to do that.
Sure.
So what I usually think, at least, and this is my own life too, you know, we all struggle with this, is like, if you're still able to have those compassionate connections with people, if you're able to reach out and help people, if you're loving the people, that will buffer you from getting taken over by your ego.
Okay.
So for me, and it's just my personal practice, because I have an ego, is I try to always funnel stuff through my heart. I'm like, is my heart open? Is my heart working? Am I looking around? And if I do that, I go, you know, you're not going to get in too much trouble.
Yeah.
You get in some trouble, but you're not going to be a total jerk.
All the time,
you're out there every day, you're focusing on, like, expanding your capacity for love a little bit, being more connected. And if you're a loving person, you probably know people like this who are kind of egomaniacs, but they really try to be loving. They try to be generous. It's not always there because sometimes they're just caught up in their own thing and they go back to it. You go, look, I can work with somebody like that.
Sure.
I know they're trying. So that to me is that, because if you start fighting the ego directly and saying, look, I don't want to be popular, I don't want to be hot, you know, it's like, well, maybe you kind of do want to be hot. You know, I don't want to be ugly.
Well, right. It'd be like trying to talk yourself out of being successful. Like, I don't want to be successful, or, you know, like, then why are we going to work every day? Like, I feel like there's a part of us all that says, I want to be successful, and that looks different for different people. But the opposite extreme seems a little inhumane, almost, like, or just kind of impossible, like an impossible standard to meet.
Right. So that's why I think it's that, again, if you focus on the heart, it keeps you from saying, look, my goal is to be powerful so I can crush people.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, my goal is to be powerful. And once I'm here, I'm going to try to lift people up with me. I'm going to try to share the view with people. I'm going to try to maybe climb back down in the mountain and give people some tips or help them out, you know, try to bring something back for the people. So I think, conceptualizing your life where there's some part in there, where there's some part of that bottom line is going out to other people.
Okay.
Is a way to balance that. Because, you know, ego's there. We have a very competitive, individualistic society, and you need some of it.
Yeah. So can there be times in your life where you're more narcissistic than other times? Like you mentioned, you know, like there's times where a person might be extremely loving or whatever, but then there could be times where they get sucked back into their own stuff. And I know, for instance, I've had, like, this year, for instance, I had a lot of really big blows work-wise, or I was just like super encompassed by a lot of things happening in my personal life. And then, of course, we all are with this pandemic, right? So I have not felt like my best, most loving self at all the time. So is that typical? Like, are there times where we can be a little more healthy and staying and out of the ego place, and then times where you just get absorbed by it for everyone? Or is that just me?
Well, no, I think that's, I think it's, you know, there's obviously differences between people, but there's two things you've touched on that I think are really important. One is that there's a general idea that if we're well rested and we're stress free, it's much easier to be nice than when we're tired and stressed out or depleted or exhausted.
Right.
You go out and work all day. Let's imagine I'm waiting tables. I'm a server at some fancy place, and you know, in Nashville, and I'm working hard. You know, pandemic's over, and I'm smiling at people who are mean to me for 8 hours, and I go home to my boyfriend, and he's like, "How's your day?" I'm like, "Shut up.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk to you.
Yeah.
I'm exhausted." And so you just get exhausted, and we kind of run our world where we try to be really nice to strangers, and then we save our meanness for those we love. It's a very strange system we
run.
So I think that to be our best self and our most loving self, you know, getting sleep, getting rest, eating nutritious diet, not being, you know, on a sugar low with it. It's like the clinical psychologists always say, hungry, angry, lonely, tired.
Yes, I know that one.
You know, those are kind of those kind of things that will lead to stress. And if you know, if when you're stressed, you become narcissistic, it's going to make it worse. You're still not going to be more loving. You might be more angry. You might be more hostile.
Mm-hmm.
So I think just a general ease in life will help. The other thing are ages, you know, developmental trends. And, you know, you're 18, 19, you're going to be more focused on yourself. 21, you have a lot of self-focus.
Yeah.
You're trying to build a career. You're trying to figure out who you are. And then at some point, maybe you go, okay, I've got my foot in the career. I'm building something. Now I want to step out and have a family. And maybe then I've got to be less self-focused. You know, and then maybe once my family's gone, I got to get my kids through college. So I got to be self-focused again. So some models in psychology talk about life as is sort of a series of cycles, some more narcissistic, some more interpersonal. And some people talk about life as one, you know, there's this sort of major cycle when you're young, you're a little more selfish. And when you get older and you get sort of put into the system, you get married, you work, you're kind of doing your thing, you become a little more socialized, you're a little less narcissistic, you're a little more focused on the system.
Okay, that makes actual total sense. Because I think about when I graduated college and I was like applying for my first jobs, I had such an entitlement. This is what I always tell like young 20-somethings. I literally was like, oh, I'm going to walk into these places and they're going to be so happy to hire me, you know? And then you get out there and you're like, oh, wait, first of all, there's a million other people just like me. And they are more hardworking, or they went to a better school, or they made better grades. Like there's all these different things that I think reality hits and you switch out of that entitlement. But I've seen a lot of people really struggle with that, or, you know, like that's a huge tip I try to give like my young interns that work for me and stuff, is just like, stop thinking that you deserve anything and really like put the work in to earn it.
Yeah, and that is, I mean, this is one of the, I mean, I wrote a lot about generational differences in the past, and this stuff comes up, and some of it's developmental, and it's, but yeah, you're told for a long period of time that you're awesome.
Yeah.
And you're in school, and you're told you're awesome, and you're told you're going to be a winner.
Yeah.
And you're not.
Right.
And no one promised you that, and it's not fair, and it really sucks, and so that transition, you know, getting your ego crashed, is really painful to people.
Yeah.
And that's why I give the examples of like gig wave surfers or fighters or people like that are often super nice because they just have got crushed so many times. They've lost so many times. They become humble and really more loving in a way. But what's interesting about your story too is you went for it. You're like, I thought I was a cat's ass and I went for it. So at least you went for it, you know?
I guess, yeah.
And you know, I grew up, I was, you know, when I was young, I was really insecure, really anxious. And, you know, I'd go for stuff, but it was just gut check.
Yeah.
You know, if anyone liked me, I was like, oh my God, they must not know who I am. And that's not fun either. So, you know, that ego, when you start something, isn't bad to go out there and do it, as long as you're able to sort of take that ego off pretty quickly when you realize you're not that special.
Yeah. That was a huge one.
And it's hard. And the other thing, I think it's funny when you're bringing this up, because I, I started judging myself as I got older and studied this. I thought, you know, when I'm the dumbest person at the table, that's when I know I've made it.
That's interesting.
So as an academic, as an academic, I've gone to dinner and I've looked around the table. I thought, these are the smartest people I've ever seen in my life. And I thought, I'm sitting with them. And they don't know that I shouldn't be here. This is as good as it gets.
Well, that's such a good way to look at it, though, because I think a lot of times what I hear people say, or what I deal with, is that imposter syndrome. And so instead of going, oh my gosh, I shouldn't be here, you're just like happy to be there with these people.
It's a way of kind of just embracing imposter syndrome a little more.
Yeah.
You know, imposter syndrome is totally normal, and it's normal for people, especially when you're rising through a system. So every time you start something, you're like, oh my God, I'm a grad student. Oh my God, I'm a professor. This is crazy.
Yeah.
And you kind of do that your whole life. But if you're not doing that, I always tell my students, it's very easy to set up a world where, like, you don't get rattled and you're the, everything. You mm-hmm. just set up a very small world mm-hmm. for yourself where you're the boss, and you won't be threatened, and you won't grow. But if you want to grow, you have to be comfortable being an idiot and being the dumbest person in the room.
I
often.
Love that, though. Yes, that is so true.
And then what you start doing, you start going, oh my God, look how surrounded by these, I'm such an idiot, and I'm on this stage with all these great people. And you start getting reinforced for that. You start going, this is great, I'm doing it right. So you start to be able to embrace your failings. And that's when you start to grow.
Yes. A new thing I started doing too, when I feel that feeling of like, oh God, I don't know what I'm doing, or I'm starting something new and I see other people doing it so easily. What I try to say to myself now is, to like, look at what they're doing, look at what they're doing well and learn from it, and just go, I can do that too. I'm in the same place now. I maybe don't know how to do it yet, but like, I like how he does that, or I like how she does this part, and just take those as lessons instead.
Yes, because one of the things that happens with narcissism, you see this with vulnerable narcissism in particular, but grandiose as well, is you see envy.
Oh, yeah.
So, oh, look at those people. It's so easy for them. It's just not fair. Screw them. I'm going to trip them up.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk on their back. I'm going to shame them. And, I see myself doing stuff like that. I'm going, God, you just sound like an envious little child. You're acting. And it's much better to say, God, look at these people that are so successful. I'm so glad they did this, because I can learn from them. Mm-hmm. And I, like you said, take what they're doing well and apply it to me and modify it. And this is awesome. And then I'll internalize. But you have to let go of your ego to be able to do that.
Yeah.
You say, look, I'm learning. I'm growing. I'm changing. This is the process. And there's a step to do that, because you're not the best.
Right. Right. I want to talk a little bit about measuring narcissism, because you have a lot in your book about actually the science by which you guys are starting to change how you measure narcissism. And we mentioned a little bit the NPI, and I took the test and I had a hard time, because some of the questions I felt like I didn't identify with either. And some of the questions I felt like I could identify with both. And so then it was like, how do I answer?
Yeah, that's a strange test. So a little bit of history. There's been several ways we've measured narcissism, but the test that got really popular in the 80s, and it's still going strong, it's called the Narcissistic Personality Inventory. And it's a strange test, in that most of what we do, if you take a psychology test, we'll say, we'll put it on a 5-point scale. If I ruled the world, there'd be a much better place. 1 to 5. 5 is definitely
right.
1 is not at all.
Yeah.
That's usually how you do it.
Yes.
So, but there's problems with self-report, and, sometimes people just say what they think is the right thing to say. And so what they did with this scale and some others at the time is they use what's called a forced choice. So they give you 2 questions and you have to pick one. But the challenge is both those questions are kind of socially acceptable. So, for example, it might be, hey, Keith, if you ruled the world, it would be a much better place. versus ruling the world frightens the hell out of me. So I have to make a choice. And I'm thinking, well, if I ruled the world, I couldn't do any better than anyone else.
Right.
I mean, what do I know? I'm not that narcissistic. But does it scare the hell out of me? Oh, I think it would be super fun to rule the
right.
world. I'd love to do it.
This is exactly what was happening to me when I was taking it.
Right.
Yeah.
So which one do I pick? And then it's kind of 50-50. And so what that means is your score is probably going to, you can probably put the narcissistic one on one and the non-narcissistic on another and probably hit up. I'm going to ask you what your score was, unless you want to tell me, but.
I don't think I do. Because I got it and I was like, what?
No, but a lot of times that's just the framing. And you see the framing with that. It makes it interesting because you're answering with those forced choice, you're going to answer a little differently. If it were a 1 to 5 scale, you might say, if I ruled the world, you know, it'd be a much better place. 3 out of 5.
Totally. Yes.
Right.
So is it accurate, though? That's the question. Is that how we're measuring narcissism? And if so, is that a very accurate way to do that?
It's that forced choice format that it works reasonably well, but I think a 5-point Likert scale is a better, I mean, sorry to these words, it's more psychometrically sound.
Yeah.
So I mean, my student Brittany built one. So we built some 5-point scales. The nice thing about the NPI and the reason I like the forced choice for people to take is because we have so many people taking that 40-item version. And we have a pretty good idea what the means are, so it makes it easy to compare yourself to other people.
What do you mean?
Meaning if you got, let's say there's a 40-point narcissism scale, and I can say, you know, the average score is about, you know, for somebody your age is probably, I'm just going to say a 13.
Okay.
And 12, I don't know. And the average score of a president is estimated to maybe be 25, and the average comedian maybe is a 19. And you kind of get numbers for it.
Okay.
Because we've done it with so many samples. But it would be much better if we had a 5-point scale that we'd given to all those different people.
Right.
You know, we just don't have it. It's just the history of how this was made and how it kind of stuck around. And, you know, we've built better scales since then, but they're just haven't been used as much. So it's harder to find comparison groups and they're a little longer and things.
Yeah. Well, I will say when I took it and I got my score and it was higher than I would have liked, I at first was like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. But then I started reading, or I kept reading more, and you were saying, like, if you score high, don't be alarmed. It's just interesting to recognize maybe some traits about you. So then I started thinking through kind of my year, like I was saying to you earlier, and I actually think I answered some of the questions based on how I've been lately, whereas when I look at my life on a grander scheme of, like, even like maybe when I'm in my healthier place, the answer is different. So it's like, it's not always one or the other. And so it kind of made me think about, okay, well, maybe right now this is something that I could look at in certain characteristics or in certain areas of my life, even maybe where I've been a little bit too self-focused or too self-absorbed. And then I can look at it and go, okay, what can I do better? Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. And I think that, so first of all, these score, like your personality is going to fluctuate over time. It's going to change in some ways that are kind of developmentally appropriate. You know, most people over time, they become maybe a little nicer as they get older.
Yeah.
Maybe they get old and they get a little less open to experience when they're in their oldest age, a little more, you know, concrete in how they think. So there are these sort of changes people go through, but also, if you measure even narcissistic personality inventory, the extreme forms, people will have it and they won't have it for 6 months and it'll come back. So people are fluctuating around these scores depending on what's going on in their life. So what you're saying, it makes perfect sense, just like it would for anxiety. You know,
mm-hmm.
Anxiety scores are much higher. I don't know if they're much higher. What I can tell chatting with people that anxiety and depression has probably gone up during the pandemic.
Oh, I would assume so. Sure, yeah.
Yeah, it seems that way in the data. You know, I don't publicly, I try to be a little more cautious. But yeah, just the ones I talk to, people like that, I think dosing of medicines is probably going up, but no one's done their study on it yet.
Right.
I mean, like, and anxiety meds, I bet people's doses are going up, but I've only heard that anecdotally. So, I mean, that's an example where people are changing because of a social situation, and narcissism could do that as well. I mean, part of it, people are so isolated right now.
Totally. Well, right. I mean, you're with yourself all the time, so it makes it a lot easier to just focus on you and your needs and all of that stuff.
Right, because that's, well, what do you do? You're stuck with your kids, and you're trying to just survive. You're stuck
right.
with yourself, and everyone's like, well, you got 6 months. Are you going to become a great person? You're like, what? I'm so depressed. I just want to
get out of bed. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I just want to get out of bed, maybe eat.
Right.
And I'd make it till 5 so I can start drinking.
Right.
But this is America, and like, we're a high-achieving culture, and like, well, did you learn Spanish?
Exactly.
How come you don't know Spanish?
Did you learn how to bake banana bread? That's what...
Yes, so it's just, we live in this, there's a lot of pressure to perform.
Yes.
And I love it about America. I'm not anti-American anyway. I love that. But it's also exhausting and devastating for people to just, it's hard for people to look, it's a freaking pandemic. I'm depressed. I don't know what to do. Just want to sleep.
Right.
Just want to survive this thing, and then I'll work up on the other side.
Well, let's kind of talk about that then, because you mentioned our society being such a, a highly like performance-based society. And I think the pandemic has clearly rocked that for a lot of people. I know that's been a huge thing for me, is like asking myself the questions, who am I now? Because so much of my identity was wrapped up into my work and my public life, like you were talking about, and just validation from that and who I work with in that celebrity world and all of that. And when that's ripped away, you're faced with yourself and a lot of other questions. But typically in our world, we have this society that's super heavy focused on social media and your appearance that way and the perception that you're putting out there. Even the reality TV stuff, I was reading in your book that there's a high narcissistic personality rate amongst reality TV stars because of the drama that they're expected to bring. And that's like a very typical characteristic, right? So can you talk a little bit about that and just like our society? Are we actually like creating a narcissistic society or making it more acceptable to be narcissistic?
Yes, there's a lot in that question. I'll just try to break it down a little bit. But so a few things you've mentioned. One is, we build a professional identity. Many of us, because of the breakdown in sort of work and jobs, we all kind of are on boss. We have to build personal brands.
Right.
So it's not just it's not just you have to be nice, Keith. It's not just you need to know a few dad jokes to get, but you also need a brand.
Right.
And so you're telling 20-year-olds you got to build a brand. And it's hard. So there's all this pressure on building these social brands, and we build brands and we get feedback for those, here's who I am, here's my feedback, and social media of course makes this super easy. So here's my brand, let me share it on Instagram. I mean, if you're a stylist, you're probably doing a lot of Instagram. I don't know, but
I am.
That would be, that's very common. So you want to show your performance and how good you are, and so you sort of are curating a brand all the time and getting feedback, and other people are doing the same thing, and you're constantly working on each other and helping each other, fighting with each other, whatever, to build these brands and this stuff, and then it all stops.
Yes.
And you're like, who am I? I mean, all I know is I'm a machine that builds brands and an identity and gets feedback. And when that feedback stops, it all just kind of falls to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an existential crisis. I mean, that's kind of what happens. Who am I? What am I here for?
Mm-hmm.
So I think this transition, my guess, when I try to think of positive stuff about the pandemic, which I've tried to do a few times, especially when I was really depressed by it,
right,
is that it's going to give people a chance to really look inward. And a lot of people are reflecting on what they're doing and who they want to be. And is this right for me? And if it's not right, what should I do that's more authentic or that's more real?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, everybody's like, I'm moving to Montana. I don't know, everybody I know is moving to Montana. And
that
like,
sounds nice.
You've been to Montana in the winter?
Yeah, winters are brutal, but it's beautiful.
But they never have, you know, they're just right. I'm like, good for you. You know, maybe I'll move to Montana. So I think people are having that issue. And I think this is like what is bringing up with you is happening with a lot of people. It's just identity is so hooked into a rapidly moving economy. And when that's gone, you know, it all kind of falls apart.
Right.
The other issue is about how we're selecting people for a lot of these things. And social media selects, and when I use the word select, so this is sort of it's like an industry term, but selects for means it pulls for, it attracts or draws in narcissism. So social media pulls for narcissism, meaning we all use social media to some extent or another, but people who are narcissistic tend to be really better at it. They tend to have more connections, more mm-hmm. friends, mm-hmm. more interactions. You know, take selfies and they feel good about it and they share them and it's just easier for them to use social media. So social media selects for narcissism, especially grandiose narcissism.
Mm-hmm.
Reality television selects for narcissism because you need a bunch of people who want to be famous for nothing except for famous.
Right.
Who wants to do that? Well, somebody who's sort of narcissistic. Like, I want to be famous. Why, Keith? Why do you want to be famous? I just want people to think I'm cool. For what?
Well, that's the culture that's been created, right? Like the Kardashians, I always use them as the example. And first of all, I have to give you the little note that I did a reality TV show. And it was, but I was terrible at it. And that's why this is so fascinating to me. I actually did not enjoy it very much, but I was looking at it from a brand perspective of you can't beat that exposure. However, it ended up biting me in the ass because of my inability to do it the way that system is set up. And it kind of backfired on me. But what I've noticed is just like that, you know, the Kardashian culture of it, they make it so, it looks just so glamorous to just get famous for doing nothing or having a sex tape or being rich or, you know, any of those things. And it makes it so attainable that I think that the culture that we've created is one of people just like lusting after that almost.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. And that's really, I'd love to, I want to hear what show it was. I'm really curious.
I'll tell you after.
Okay. Yeah. I think this stuff is so fascinating. And I've never been on reality television, but I've talked to the camera people and stuff.
Yeah.
And I've heard a lot of it is you select people who want to be famous, and then there's drinking, and people kind of set up fights and set up drama. The producers will do this. I mean, one person told me, he said, you know, the only people on reality television who are real is Jackass.
Oh, I forgot about that show.
The guy was like, I work with Jackass, and those guys are truly crazy. But everything else, you know, everything else is kind of, you know, there's a lot of alcohol. It's kind of controlled. There's scripts that are being built in all the time and narratives and... I don't know if it's true. I haven't done
the
work.
I could tell you, I'll just tell you from my experience, what I did end up realizing that I enjoyed about it was that I was on two seasons. In the second season, I kind of just leaned in and opened up about things I was struggling with. And that was a way for me to connect because then I started getting, you know, on social media, lots of messages from people who had been through the same thing. And I really enjoyed that aspect of it. I love to connect with people. I love hearing stories of people who've gone through the same thing as me. Like, it just makes me feel not so alone in this world. However, the person, I was on the show very cavalierly, I'll just say it, but it was a reality TV star from the past show. And so the way that dynamic was set up was it was supposed to be real at first. And then they kind of shifted as the show needed more ratings. And I just couldn't do it. Like I literally couldn't do it because it's not my wiring to just fake something. You know, it's just like a weird dynamic to me, but it is set up like that a lot. And one person and the producers are controlling the narrative, which is just bizarre. It's weird. But some people like it even when it's negative because it doesn't, you know, any publicity is good publicity.
Right. You're getting attention. You're getting your name out there. And like, and when I, you know, and you've been around celebrity, but I usually say to academics, like, you stick your head out of the foxhole, somebody's going to shoot you.
Right.
And generally, half the people hate your guts.
That's exactly right. I learned that lesson. Like
I mean, I'll do this podcast, and I'll probably somebody will write reviews like, that Campbell, what an idiot. He doesn't know anything, you know. And he's fat. That's my favorite when they comment on my weight. I'm like, oh,
like, it has
God,
nothing to do with what you said.
That's what always kills me. It's like, God, you're fat. I'm like, oh, that hurts. You know, that's the nature of it. Like, that's just the nature of our modern society. Is, you know, they put you out there, and people love, you know, it's nice getting the fame, but some people just like attention because they feel they matter. It makes sense. I mean, I don't know. I'd probably go on a reality show if somebody ever asked
Don't
me.
Do it. Don't do it.
Don't do it.
Well, it feels good until it doesn't. You know what I mean? Like, the attention feels nice when it's working for you, but when it doesn't feel so good.
That's, yeah, I, fame is, anyway.
It's a whole different beast.
With my, you know, with research every once in a while, you write an article. So back in the day when Facebook came out, I was like, oh my God, there's narcissism. So I got my student Laura. I'm like, let's study this. And that's when we just kind of first figured out that there is some link between narcissism and social media. And there's been a lot of research since.
Yeah.
But we first did the study. Some newspaper picked it up and said, Facebookers are narcissists. That became like the headline.
Right.
On the Drudge Report. And, you know, I'm getting hate mail, and my poor student Laura, I'm like, Laura, go talk to people and be famous. And she's like, I love this fame, for about a day.
Mm-hmm.
And then a day and a half into it, she's like, fame sucks.
It's not that great.
How's that hate mail going?
Right.
This is awful. But it was really cool because she got to go through a whole fame cycle in a day. And learn that it's really not as great as it sounds. But that's a hard lesson to learn unless you do it because you want to be famous. This is America.
Of course. And no one, as much as you could go, yeah, but you're getting all this hate mail or these bullies, everyone's kind of like, yeah, but you get X, Y, and Z. That seems so much better. And I guess it just depends on what's more important to you. But for me, it wasn't worth it. Like, I did not enjoy the death threats or the bullying or the, like, that's not worth it to me. I would rather just go about my life, you know, but for some people, right, they don't care.
But that's really interesting for narcissism, because you think about narcissism is like, you don't have that interpersonal love piece isn't as important. It's not that you can't love, but that piece of love isn't as important as that piece for being loved or being admired or being noticed.
Being noticed. So that's like, interesting.
Yeah. So people are like, you know what? Sure, some people hate me, but I'm noticed, and that matters more.
Wow. That's
what when I go to bed at night, I'm sort of thinking, I got noticed, that's pretty bitching.
Yeah.
And other people are like, you know, I want to be loved, and that's pretty good.
Yeah.
And a lot of us, you know, want both. And we go to bed going, you know, I'm loved, and my puppy's here, but God, I wish I were famous and noticed. And, you know, other people are going out, I'm famous, I wish my puppy were here. it's a trade-off. And the other thing you mentioned in there, as I have a student who actually studies celebrities, Patrick, and what he's noticed in some of his work is that people who are being authentic and revealing things like talking about, you know, coming out videos or coming out as depressed, or coming out as gay or coming out as, you know, having some sort of trauma or whatever, people really respond to that.
Yeah.
That it's a way that people can gain followers and gain status. And he told me, and my student, Pat, just, like I said, not, I don't know this as well, so, but what he's told me is certain people will just do these coming out videos over and over.
What do you mean?
So, meaning they'll do a video on YouTube and say, yeah, I just, you know, I want to talk about the depression I had in high school and how I almost killed myself. It was really hard, and I've never shared this before, and you talk about it. And then 6 months later, they go, you know, that depression video works so well, they do it again. They go, you know, I haven't really talked about this much, but let me talk about some of the depression I suffered back in high school.
Wait, so this...
And they'll do it again.
But that's okay. That's what my question is between like these lines of what is like a healthy, or I don't even know if healthy is the right word, but an appropriate amount of narcissism. And like, what is the difference between what you just described and then like someone who's just authentically like, when you say that, I started to think through what I've done, because I'm pretty open about a lot of my life, but I always feel, and I don't, maybe I'm just completely not in touch with myself at all. I don't feel like that. But like what I feel is when I'm like, it feels like connecting with people, and like when I feel in my authentic self, when I'm actually just being genuine about what's actually going on versus like trying to make my life seem perfect or presenting this perfect picture. And so for me, like I have been really open, but am I just like the way you made it sound just now is that people use that and kind of like, I'm doing air quotes, authenticity to get more followers, which doesn't feel authentic at all, actually.
So every time in nature there's something authentic, like a poisonous snake or a moth that makes you sick if you eat it, or a poisonous fish, there will be a mimic who will do the same thing because it works, but they won't have the authenticity to it. So there'll be a butterfly that's poisonous that no one else eats, so all the birds won't eat it, and there'll be another butterfly that looks kind of the same that's pretty healthy.
Okay.
And so what happens is, when you have something that people respond to, like authenticity at scale, so talking about, you know, and this is a very powerful thing. If you're willing to reveal things about yourself, people will respond to it.
Mm-hmm.
People will do that authentically because that's how they're wired. They feel that there's, anyway, they feel there's an authentic self and an inauthentic self. Other people don't have that same wiring. They're more willing to kind of shift their self around for the situation. And in the West, we see that as sort of manipulative or inauthentic, but sometimes that might not be. It's just, it could be called acting.
Right. You know? Right.
And it could be a skill. And some people will use acting to kind of get the same rewards. So rather than real tears, their tears might be inauthentic. But in their eyes, they're like, look, it's working. I'm doing mm-hmm. this performance, and people are responding to it in an authentic emotional way, just as like if I recited a play by Yeats or played a George Martin song. Is he the Sad Country Guy? I'm sorry. I was trying to relate to your audience. There with George Martin. George Jones.
George Martin.
I was like,
George Jones. Yes.
I mixed up the Rat Pack with the Country Pack. I apologize. But George Jones, is that guy crying every time he sings a song, you know,
no.
about all the rooms in the house? I mean, it's performance. So,
right.
So I like to think that there's a lot of room there, and I'm, you know, and some people are like, look, I can perform and really do this, and maybe I don't feel it, but I perform, and other people like, I really want it to be authentic. But that connection of revealing parts of yourself is really an important way to form relationships with everybody.
I mean, that's,
you form them all the time. You sit there and you tell, and usually how it works is you say, yeah, here's something about myself. And I say, yeah, here's something about myself.
It's right.
kind of vulnerable too. And we both kind of share these things a little bit and get to know each other. So it's a really powerful way to bring people together, but I can use that on social media and say, look, I'm going to share part of myself. Everyone in the audience is going, yeah, I'm going to share part of myself with you. And all of a sudden, I have like 1,000 fans who think we're buddies.
Right. But aren't you kind of in some ways, like, didn't you connect on the same, on a level of understanding of each other?
I mean, maybe you do, you know? I think so. I mean, I have, you know, relationships with artists who I've never met, but I feel like I understand their emotions.
Yeah.
I listen to their lyrics and helps me understand how I'm feeling. So I think I don't want to say all this stuff is good or all this stuff is bad. I try to look at things as much as possible as trade-offs.
Yeah. I actually really like that trade-off piece. I think that's huge.
Yeah. Especially in, you know, in businesses that involve, you know, being attractive and getting people to like you.
Right.
You know, it's just going to be a trade-off. And being in the public eye is really hard. People, you've talked about that. So.
Yeah. But I mean, it can be even in everyday life, even if you're not in the public eye, like you said, when you go to work, you might have to put on a certain demeanor that if you take home is not going to consistently work in your relationships. And so I think that's like an interesting, the trade-off piece, or like you can be one way, but maybe not all the time.
Yes. And being flexible with who you are and saying, look, I'm this way here, I'm this way here. Underneath it all, I try to be a moral, ethical person who wants to grow and be, you know, learn and grow and,
yeah,
and do good. And, you know, I have this broader self, but I'm willing to modify it in different environments to kind of get what I need and be a better person.
Right. So what do we need to be on the lookout? Because, I mean, your book really kind of details the way you guys are measuring it these days. I do highly recommend this to you guys if you are interested in narcissism. It was very fascinating to me. You also really break down narcissism and relationships, which for me personally was a really great thing. I didn't know you had another book called When You Love a Man Who Loves Himself. I'm like going to order that immediately. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I wrote that When You Love a Man Who Loves Himself. I wrote that when I was a, you know, assistant professor. And I went to so many dinners with women who were like, you're talking about my ex-husband.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about my ex-boyfriend. I just kind of wrote it. It's a little bit dated, but it gets those ideas across, I think. That was the goal, at least.
Well, so what is it that we need to be on the lookout for situations like that, like in relationships? And then also situations with yourself, because as I said, I was reading this book kind of noticing some things that I was like, I do kind of do that sometimes, and maybe I don't like love that about myself. So what should we be on the lookout, and when is it a worrisome trait versus, or when is it a just a part of your personality trait to then like a worrisome trait or maybe even a disorder?
Yeah, so the looking at other people piece is hard, because people who are really narcissistic don't often present that way if they want you to like them. So they might act that way if you're just waiting tables on them. But if you're in a dating situation or workplace, you're hiring them, you know, you don't see it necessarily.
Right.
So one big thing to do with people is just look at their history. And people who are narcissistic will have a history of wrecked relationships behind them. You'll see a trail of victims. If you look, and you see this like with the Me Too stuff, you know, one name will come up and there'll be 10 other names.
Yeah.
And so there's often, you know, I've described it before as people really narcissistic, almost being like hurricanes that go through life and just leave a trail of destruction behind them. And they might seem really appealing, but you go back and you'll see that trail, but it's hard to do. In yourself, you know, in our research, and student Chelsea Sleep did a lot of this work. It was great, but she asked people, you know, the idea was originally, you know, years ago, I thought people who are narcissistic just didn't care. They're like, I'm a dick, but I don't care about people. I only care about myself. It doesn't really matter. And we looked at hundreds of people, and it really seems like people who are narcissistic see it can be a problem. And where they see that problem is primarily interpersonal, meaning they just, there's this idea, I don't have the love or affection I need in my life. So they might say, yeah, I need more narcissism at work because I'm not successful enough. I need to be more aggressive, more competitive, more look out for number one. But in my personal life, I want more love. And so my sense with people is if you feel you're missing connection or emotional intimacy, your capacity for love is smaller than it should be. I think those are the things you can work on, and they're not going to mess up your work. You know, being a more loving person isn't going to make you a worse country music star.
Right.
I mean,
it might actually make you better.
It might actually make you better, because there's going to be somebody's going to have to put together a production shoot for something. They're going to say, yeah, I want Keith because he's not a total jerk. He's easy to get along with.
Right. Right.
I don't want Keith because he's kind of a prima donna.
Yeah.
You know, we don't, a freaking diva. We don't need a diva on this site. We just need people who are cool.
Yeah.
And work, they talk about this sometimes, is the no asshole rule. Have you heard that phrase?
I have not. Sort of a,
this is kind of a workplace version of it. It's not too much celebrity, but people, you know, there's even a book called The No Asshole Rule, but it's a policy in hiring where you say, look, even though no matter how talented this person is, if they're kind of a jerk, I don't want them around. And so this is something organizations will use just as a screening device. Like, I don't care how good you are, you got to be a decent human being.
Yeah.
So that interpersonal piece, being a nice person, getting along with people, that's where I really try to focus.
Okay. I really like that. The book is called The New Science of Narcissism. It comes out September 29th. Dr. Campbell, where else can people find you?
WKeithCampbell.com.
Okay.
Website and NarcissismLab.com. We put together a site with some of the narcissism tests on there if people want to try them. I think we've got three up there, the NPI and a vulnerable measure. Okay. So those two places.
Nice. Okay. Well, you guys go check him out. Like I said, the book comes out on September 29th. I'm going to put the link to purchase it in my bio of this podcast. Especially if you know anything about narcissism, I do feel like this book dives into like a little deeper of the study of how you guys are measuring it now, what you're learning. It was very, very interesting to me. So I really appreciate you being here and sharing all of that with us. And you guys go check out the book, and thank you guys for listening.